This is a production of Cornell University.
All right, everybody, we're going to get started. It is 5:35. I'm going to call the meeting to order. Hope everybody had a really good break. Go ahead and get into the roll call.
Chris Dinklin. Samuel Bresani. Ben Parker.
Here.
Kate Carter-Cram.
Here.
Charles Bay. Jordan Dossel. Cody Jewell.
Here.
Ruth Epstein.
Here.
Natalie Gonzalez. Bridget Hayes.
Here.
Amara Nayatali. Kyle Carnata.
Here.
David Pett.
Here.
Alexandra Piasova.
Here.
Dorothy Lane. Jack Levin. Genesis Lee.
Here.
Chen Liu.
Here.
Stephanie Lopez. Melina Matthews. Harshad Mehta.
Here.
Miranda Minnelli.
Here.
Chris O'Connor.
Here.
Christina Onewa.
Here.
Noriella Perez.
Here.
Alexandra Fresher. Damian Sharp.
Here.
Georgia Smith.
Here.
Caroline Steingard. William Wayne. Josh Washington.
Here.
Meredith Welch.
Here.
And Anna Wood.
Here.
We have 23 voting members present.
All right, thank you. Okay, so we'll move on to any late additions to the agenda. Anybody, anything they want to add before we move on? All right, so we'll move on to approving the meeting minutes for November 15th meeting. Does anybody have any changes or amendments needed to be made to those? Okay, so any motions to approve meeting minutes?
Motion to approve the meeting minutes.
Okay. Any objections? Okay, any objections to unanimously approving the meeting minutes?
I'd actually like to abstain because I wasn't here, so I can't.
Okay. Well, I guess seeing none, we'll just approve the meeting minutes then. let's see. So, President Pollock is supposed to be here in about 7 or so minutes. We will be doing breakout session by division after that, so until she arrives, if we just want to take a second and just let her get here and get set up. So we'll reconvene at 5:45.
All right, everybody. We will reconvene. So we're going to move on to the presentation part of our evening. We're very happy to welcome Martha Pollock, president of the university. So we give her a round of applause.
Thank you, Pastor. A much, much better room than that really steep room you guys used to meet in. So, first of all, I apologize that I had to postpone my visit. Well, a couple weeks ago, I just had a cold, but I had to go get a negative test before I could come on campus. So that's why I wasn't here. Also, I want to note one miscommunication, which is entirely our fault. There's a briefing form I get for any meeting I go to, and that briefing form gives me advice about what to wear, told me that I'm supposed to be wearing business or business casual. It was never meant to apply to you guys. One of the great benefits of being a graduate student is you can wear whatever you want. So I apologize about that confusion. A few comments, but the first thing is, I do just want to acknowledge that the last year and a half have, of course, been really difficult for everyone all over the world, like for everyone, but that includes our Cornell faculty, staff, and students. All of you have experienced stress. All of you experienced a lot of stress. Many of you took classes online. You taught classes online. You had your travel or your research interrupted. Some of you have been dealing not only with public health challenges, but related challenges of limited childcare or unpredictable school closings. You know, in some cases, you even dealt with illness or loss of family and friends. And many of you, I'm sure, have gone months without being able to go home and visit family and friends far away. And then, of course, earlier this month, along with several of our Ivy peers, we had the stress of a bomb threat, and then that was followed by the shelter-in-place order on North Campus. It's been a lot to deal with. And I've been really impressed, really awed, by the way our community has come together to do the things we need to do, not just to stay open, but to continue moving forward in our academic mission, what we're all here for. And so on that note, I really want to thank all of you who, in the midst of so many extraordinary pressures, have continued to invest your time and effort moving that work forward through GPSA. I know that all of you know that GPSA matters or you wouldn't be here, but I want to tell you from my point of view and from Dean Bohr's point of view just how key GPSA is to the graduate school and to the university leadership. You are what help us understand the needs and concerns of our graduate students, enabling us to help you succeed. So on behalf of the university and your fellow graduate students and professional students, your work is supporting all of them. Thank you for all the work you do to keep GPSA running effectively. Now, I mentioned a few minutes ago that despite the crazy times that we're living in, Cornell continues to move forward in its academic mission. And I want, as I always do, to start by sharing a few of the ways in which we're doing that. But I do so with the knowledge that for many, it's been difficult or even impossible to be as productive as normal during this period. So I want to reiterate, that's okay. On the one hand, I want to sort of give you a sense that we're moving forward. But if you've struggled, that's okay. Be kind to yourself. So let me tell you a little bit about some of the things that our graduate students have achieved. You, our graduate students, have achieved in just the last year, just in 2021, you've received 2 Ford Fellowships, 3 Mellon International Dissertation Research Fellowships, a 2-year, $240,000 National Science Foundation grant, 3 Facebook Fellowships, and 3 other doctoral students were finalists for the Facebook Fellowships. I like this one a lot, a Woman in Triticom Early Career Award. This is an award for early career females who are working on wheat. So somebody from CALS, I presume. 44 new graduate research fellowship awardees. And then just before Thanksgiving, Bhargav Sinkhetti, a doctoral candidate in biochemistry, molecular, and cell biology, placed 3rd in the 2021 3-minute thesis competition with his presentation, To Be or Not, that's K-N-O-T, To Be, Blueprint for a Small Intestine. So congratulations. I'm sure there are many more prizes I've forgotten, but those are all really very, very impressive achievements. You chose to come to Cornell to study and train under world-class scholars, so let me share just a few of their recent achievements. 8 Cornell faculty plus 1 emeritus professor have recently been elected to the National Academies. This is really the highest honor you can get in this country in many fields. Roberto Sierra and Mijin Yoon were elected to the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Maureen Hansen and Bernice Grafstein were elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Jeff Tester, an emeritus professor, Lance Collins, to the National Academy of Engineering. Anurang Agrawal and Maureen Hansen, again, to the National Academy of Science. And Hugh Hemmings to the National Academy of Medicine. I also want to congratulate, we have a number of assistant professors. 3 received National Science Foundation Early Career Awards. Another received a career award, an early career award from the U.S. Department of Energy. Now, I only want to mention one more. Again, there's lots and lots and lots of prizes our faculty have won. But there's one that is really groundbreaking and incredibly prestigious. And it's an example, again, of what the people you came here to study with are doing. So Scott Emmer, the Frank H.T. Rhodes, class of 1956, professor of molecular biology and genetics, and also director of the Weill Institute for Cell and Molecular Biology, was awarded the Shaw Prize in Life Science and Medicine this past summer for his landmark discovery of the endosomal sorting complexes required for transport, that's pronounced escort pathway, This award, the Shaw Prize, is often referred to as the Nobel Prize of Asia. It's extremely impressive. So to all of our graduate students, all of our faculty, I really just scratched the surface of a long and impressive list. Congratulations to everyone. All right, change in topic. Let me give you some other updates from around the university. Sustainability, of course, continues to be a key priority for us. We have the goal of being a carbon neutral campus by 2035. So I think it's kind of cool that the Sierra Club has a ranking, the cool school ranking, based on really objective metrics, things such as energy use, air and climate, transportation, and engagement. They ranked 312 universities and colleges, and Cornell ranked number 4. We were the number 4 cool school in this country for our sustainability efforts. Those strengths are largely due to the Cornell Atkinson Center for Sustainability and its significant work in that area. And again, that includes a lot of work by graduate students. So there are recent publications on everything from electric vehicle batteries, recycling solar panels, plastic waste chemical recycling, using bacteria to store and retrieve renewable energy, and the role of tree-killing pests in accelerating climate change, all of which have involved contributions by graduate and professional students. As a land-grant university, Cornell also has an institutional commitment to engagement and civic responsibility, and we pursue that work in numerous ways. But again, I'm just going to give you an example, and this involves our law students. Any law students here? Do you happen to work in the law school's asylum clinic? Okay, well, nonetheless, last year, law school students under the direction of that clinic successfully litigated an appeal to the U.S. Board of Immigration Appeals by Zoom, which ended up in the release of Cuban physician and asylum seeker Merlis Rodriguez Hernandez, who had been trapped in a detention center and had become ill with COVID during the pandemic. And then in May, with the support of her law clinic team and a team from the Weill Cornell Center for Human Rights, Rodriguez Hernandez told her story in a really harrowing first-person graphic essay in the New England Journal of Medicine. I encourage you to read it. Her name is Rodriguez Hernandez, and it's really quite an amazing story. So kudos to our law students who successfully worked for her release. Okay, a couple of updates on university finances, because I know that's always of interest really to everyone. You probably saw the announcement of our endowment returns. Our endowment had like a remarkable year. None of us have ever seen anything like it. There was a 41.9% growth in investments. That was due to a number of factors, including a very robust market and a multi-year effort by our investment team to restructure asset classes, reduce fees, and implement rigorous risk monitoring and rebalancing frameworks. Now, I want to remind you of how endowments work. Many of you know, some of you may not. The endowment isn't just a big pool of money. It's actually about 8,000, more than 8,000 separate accounts, almost all of which are restricted to a particular use by the donor who gave us that money. So if a donor comes in and says, I want my money to pay for a first year fellowship in anthropology, then the earnings from that funds, they get invested, they earn interest, those earnings can only be put to that use. Moreover, the gifts are intended to be permanent. So in other words, the money that's given to us needs to be invested in such a way that we use some of the earnings for the intended purpose, the student stipend, the student health plan, and so on for that first year anthropology student. And then we reinvest the rest of those earnings so that we have enough in future years to cover the cost of that stipend and health insurance, including inflation. And also to provide the stipend and health insurance when endowment earnings are below what should be paid out. And it is important to note that the endowment is very volatile, very volatile. It was 41.9% this year. Last year it was 1.9%, which was actually less than inflation. So to ensure that the funds from the endowment achieve their purpose of providing stable resources for the university in perpetuity forever, we are very disciplined in our endowment spending. We have a payout formula. It's about 5% of the endowment each year. And only under extraordinary circumstances do we deviate from that at all. And when I say we, this is a board level decision. I can make a recommendation to the board, but I do not have the authority to change the endowment spending at payout. This is the board is entrusted with making sure we have these funds in perpetuity, and they have to make this change. Now, last year, in fact, our board did make a change. They decided that the pandemic was truly extraordinary, and so they approved this really exceptional one-time payout that covered essential pandemic-related costs, like the cost of setting up our own coronavirus testing laboratory, like the cost of supplemental financial aid, and so on. But in general, it's ours and it's our board's responsibility to make sure that Cornell not only has the money it needs today, but that we'll have the resources to be a great university for the next 150 years. Now, while I'm on the topic of budgets, let me note that we are in the process right now, like literally as I speak, there are people working on pulling together our proposed budget that we will take to the board for next year, for fiscal year 2023, so July 1 of 2022 through June 30th of 2023. Lots of factors we have to take into account, including pressure on undergraduate tuition, but I do want you to know that we are quite cognizant of the impact of inflation on graduate students. I don't have a specific number for you, but we are definitely factoring that into our planning for the budget. And finally, I want to say something about our new philanthropic campaign, which was publicly launched last month. So universities like ours rely a lot on gifts, both gifts to endowment, like the ones I was just talking about, and also what we call expendable gifts. These are gifts where we get to spend them, again, in ways directed by the donor, but we're not expected to save them and have the money available in perpetuity. All of that philanthropy enables us to function at the level that we do. It enables us to recruit and retain our world-class faculty, to maintain our libraries, maintain our labs, our other facilities, and support both our graduate and our undergraduate students. We are fortunate at Cornell to have incredibly generous donors. The large majority of them are alumni who want to give back to the university that shaped them. And while we're always working with our alumni to get gifts, periodically we launch these campaigns that aim to raise a large amount of money to further our mission. And that's what we've just done. The campaign is called To Do the Greatest Good. This is a phrase that Ezra Cornell himself used about 156 years ago. He had this fortune to invest. He wasn't sure what to do with it. He wanted to do, as he put it, the greatest good, and to do it for posterity. And he had lots of options. But in the end, what he decided to do was to use it for this university with its founding cry of any person, any study. So as we think about what it means to do the greatest good in today's world, we're looking at three key dimensions. The first is to educate students who will be leaders who carry the Cornell ethos forward. So that means committing to and supporting student access so that we really are a place for any person. It means promoting student wellness, and it means building on a culture of educational verve, pushing forward new ways to learn and making sure that what we do is evidence-based. Second, we aim to tackle some of the world's most challenging problems, doing what Cornell does so well, moving from theory to practice and back again. We're a place, really, I think, of remarkable openness to innovation. I've spent time at universities, and the openness to working across disciplinary boundaries here is really unparalleled, and that lets us tackle really big problems like global sustainability, human and animal health, social and economic equity, technology and society, and human creativity. And then our third key aim, the third key way in which we want to do the greatest good, is to connect Cornell with the world through public engagement, through our international programs, and of course through our expanding presence in New York City, which complements what we do up here in Ithaca. Our goals for the campaign are very ambitious, in line with our ambitions to the university. We've set a target of $5 billion. That includes $3 billion for Ithaca, $1.5 billion for Cornell for Weill Cornell Medicine, and $500 million for Cornell Tech. And as part of our commitment to opening the doors for students who come from low and moderate income, we're aiming to raise a lot in financial aid. At the undergraduate level, we're aiming to raise $500 million, $500 million. And we're going to use that to do three things: increase the number of aided undergraduates by 1,000, reduce debt for students when they graduate by an average of 25%. And ensure that all students have the opportunity to have at least one meaningful summer experience. That means waiving the summer savings expectation for students from the least well-resourced family. The colleges are all also prioritizing the raising of funds for graduate students to strengthen our ability to recruit and retain really diverse, brilliant cohorts of promising scholars. And again, The goal for graduate student support across the university is about $500 million, half a billion dollars. I honestly and truly believe that this campaign is going to ensure that we continue to be one of the greatest universities in the world. In fact, I think we can be the model of the 21st century university precisely because of our commitment to human diversity, any person, and intellectual diversity, any study. So those are my updates for all of you, and I am open for questions.
Do you want me to go through the questions you submitted?
Yeah, we can start with that first.
Okay, there's a lot of them. It's going to use up all our time.
Why don't we open it to questions?
We can alternate.
Filter. We'll filter with that.
Okay, that works.
Okay, so the first question we wanted to know, actually the first one is that, what does the future vision of the university's transportation system look like? Will it add more bike lanes, racks, request more later pickup drop-off times to TCAT, and anything else that it plans on is adding or working on? So it is absolutely true that as we think of our long-term transportation planning, it focuses on mass transit. We are actively in discussions with TCAT around current services on campus, as well as opportunities to expand service. Service, of course, got cut down during the pandemic. We're trying to get it expanded, and certainly improves campus circulation as a priority. We're continuing the development of systems for real-time info on parking for those people who don't use mass transit. The NCRE roadwork up on our campus is now complete, and that provides significantly improved pedestrian safety, crosswalk signages, bus pull-up lanes. We're adding wayfinding signage early next year. The one sort of really disappointing thing is that the wire dam bridge work on the east side of campus, there were material shortages, supply chain issues, and so that was expanded. It took longer, but we now expect that it will be done by the end of December, weather permitting.
In person or via Zoom.
So first, thank you for joining. You listed a lot of really ambitious ideas for the philanthropic campaign that you mentioned. And I'm wondering sort of what you see, what is the timeline for starting to sort of roll those things out?
Oh, great question. So the campaign itself will go on for five more years. When you launch a public campaign, to be completely honest, you've already done a quiet phase. So out of that $5 billion, we've already raised $2.6, $2.7 billion. And some of those things have already rolled out. So up here in Ithaca, for example, the gift for the School of Public Policy allowed us to open the new School of Public Policy. We already have students there. It's helping us hire faculty and so on. We got the big gift for the CIS building. And although it hasn't been built yet, we're now in the process of designing it. Down at Weill Cornell Medicine, they got a large gift for debt-free tuition for students with financial need, and that's rolling in already. So basically, the timeline, it's not that we wait till the end of the 5 years. As we get the money, we're able to do whatever it is we want to do with that money. Now, I will say one thing. Sometimes someone will give a gift to endowment, and they want it to grow to be larger. Sometimes they'll say, here's the gift to endowment, invest it, but don't do anything for 2 or 3 years because we want it to grow to a certain level before we do it. But that's not that common. Can we go to the next one?
Sure.
You know what, I'm gonna jump to the one at the end because that's the one everybody asks me about like all the time, if I can find it. And that one, it's about mental health. Every meeting I have been at in over 5 years, here with other presidents, I mean, this isn't Cornell, every meeting that topic comes up. So do you want me to read the whole question? It's long.
Sure.
Okay. In your recent visit to the Undergraduate Student Assembly, students asked you to address the insufficient access we have to mental health resources on campus. According to the Cornell Sun's reporting of the November 18th meeting, says you, Ryan Lombardi was there with me, explained that the university plans to use the mental health review and survey published last year to guide steps forward. In many ways, though, the world and our campus are significantly different than they were when this data was collected and these recommendations were made. What have you personally learned about the mental health crisis on campus this year, particularly related to graduate student well-being, and how might your evolved perspective get reflected in your actions going forward? So let me first start by telling all of you, most of you weren't there, what I told SA, because I gave a lot of information there. Mental health is absolutely a priority topic here. It's been for many years. As I say, it's not just the topic at Cornell. It's part of a national trend. Every meeting I go to is discussed nationally. Given the data on mental illness among university students nationally, undergraduate and graduate, we would expect that about a quarter to a third of our population at Cornell will experience a mental health challenge in any given year. And like all of our peers, we continue to focus on enhancing mental health resources, but we recognize that there's more to be done. So, first of all, we're continuing to prioritize emergency access. Students who need immediate same-day care for crisis-level concerns get triaged and then connected to a team of CAPS urgent care counselors. Beyond that, right now, the wait times for non-emergency access are about 7 days, and for students to get matched to short-term individual counseling is about 2 weeks. I want to sort of put that in perspective. There was a very recent study that said the wait time for psychiatrists in major cities in the United States averaged 25 days, and it's usually worse in rural areas, and the national average for behavioral health services was a 48-day wait. So at 7 and 14 days, we're well ahead of the national average. Now, could we do better? Would we like to do better? Sure, but I give you those numbers to say that there really is a shortage of therapists all over the country. And during the first 2 years of this semester, CAPS was very much understaffed. So starting on September 30th, we began contracting with a telehealth provider, Mantra Health, to provide additional therapy and psychiatry support. The contracted telehealth services have also allow students to access providers with different identities, including therapists or people of color. So, first thing we're doing, contracting with telehealth, hiring more therapists. I do want to point out, though, that that can't be the whole solution, because honestly, our staffing ratio, number of therapists to students, significantly surpasses. It's significantly better than even the aspirational goals of the international accrediting of counseling services. So we need to think beyond clinical care. I mean, it can't just be hiring more and more and more therapists. And that's what the mental health review in 2020 pointed to. It pointed to working both to improving the mental health services that we provide and, at least as importantly, to taking a more holistic look at student wellness with the goal of addressing the causes of distress that lead students to seek mental health services in the first place. And the review identified four areas: a campus culture of competition, a lack of balance in student life, a lack of social connectedness and belonging, and decentralization. Work is going on all these, and I want to note, none of these have changed or diminished in importance during the pandemic. Indeed, what the pandemic has stressed the most has been the third of these, a lack of social connectedness, which was brought on by things like public health restrictions, restrictions on travel, and so on. So we're continuing to work on all of those, but specifically with respect to graduate students, I want to call out four initiatives that are underway, some of which are almost completed, in fact. The first are the graduate field handbooks. 95% of these have been submitted. So every field was asked to develop a handbook that clearly defines academic goals and expectations. Many fields didn't have anything explicit, and that led sometimes to a disconnect in student expectation, and that cause stress for students. Secondly, there's a group co-chaired by a faculty member and a doctoral student that is tasked with developing a set of core mutual expectations for graduate student faculty and students. So this document, which is underway now, its development's underway, will inform the development and progression of a productive advising and mentoring relationship. What does that mean? I mean, said a lot of words. It means being really clear about the expectations when a student joins a lab or forms a doctoral committee or so on. Are you supposed to be in the lab 9 to 5? Or are you expected to be there on the weekends? You know, different labs have different expectations, and when they're not clear, it can lead to problems, especially for first-generation or low-income students or international students. So that's the second graduate-related wellness initiative underway. The third is graduate advisor feedback. During the mental health review, a number of graduate students raised the concern that we don't have a formal mechanism to enable graduate students and postdoctoral fellows to provide feedback on advisor performance and to seek assistance when they need it. So there is a task force right now which is creating a system designed to prevent challenges in advisor-advisee relationships from just becoming irreconcilable, from leading to basically a divorce. This will include creating recommended pathways that enable advisees to provide confidential and ad hoc feedback on the advisee relationships, and that's due next year. And then finally, we have a program, a new faculty training program, a new faculty training program. That's a new program for new faculty, which will provide education on best practices for mentoring, for managing people and projects, and for addressing conflicts in the planning stages. Addressing conflicts in the workplace, and that program is in the planning stages. So again, the pandemic has changed things, but I don't think it's changed this basic focus on needing not just to look at the number of therapists, but to look at wellness more broadly and being responsive to the kinds of concerns that are being addressed in these four initiatives. Sorry, that was a long answer, but lots of people ask about mental health. So
we've got a question via Zoom.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that because I'm unmuted that I can ask the question?
Yes.
All right, perfect. So I actually was the person who submitted the question you just answered about mental health, so I appreciate your answer. And I think you're exactly right about the various elements that are recommended throughout the mental health reviews, such as focusing on mentorship, best practices, as well as, building Cornell Health to be able to continue accommodating. But one thing that, from my perspective as an alum, as well as on my 6 year of graduate school, so 11 years here at Cornell, one thing that you don't really speak about, which I'd like to hear a bit about, is more of the cultural dynamics of Cornell that arguably lead to some of the mental health challenges that we're seeing right now, especially what can't necessarily be addressed by, more therapists. So things like graduate students trying to help undergraduates in our classes who can't access resources, or not having breaks when traumatic things happen on campus, those kind of things. So I'd like to hear a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, the first example that you give, obviously one way we address that is by adding more therapists, and then the undergraduates can get in more quickly for that. On the not giving breaks, so there were calls after the bomb scare and the person with the gun who was running around actually in my backyard, and various other places just off campus, to cancel classes. But canceling classes was just not a solution. First of all, not all classes are the same. Some classes have different sections, and if you just cancel a day, the sections get out of sync. Sometimes students are doing labs, and the labs are sequential, and if you miss a lab, you're just messed up for the rest of the semester. Sometimes students have prepared a presentation paper class. They're ready to go. It actually adds stress to the delay of class. And that gets to the second point, which is, while there were lots of students who wanted breaks, there were lots of other students who said, no, please don't do that. It's going to be more stress for me. It's a little bit like the discussion during the pandemic about whether we should have mandatory pass-fail. Students on both sides were absolutely convinced that everyone was on their side, and that simply wasn't true. Finally, things like the bomb scare or the shelter in place, they don't just affect students. They affect everyone on campus. And, the staff who were making food up on North Campus had to keep working. They had to feed the students that day. If you you can't just send everyone home. Someone has to feed the students. Someone has to, come and unplug clogged toilets. Someone has to make sure that IT is running. We are kind of like a little mini city, so you can't just shut a city down. And that's why we keep opening and ask students to take the initiative. If you are really struggling, then talk to your faculty members. Go and see Cornell Health. Do what you need to do. Culture more broadly is not something you can change from the top. Culture has to be changed by everyone, and if you're seeing things that are problematic, it's as much on you as it is on me to try and change that culture. You can't sort of dictate culture.
It looks like Becca has a follow-up question, but we should be respectful. Yeah, we should be respectful of time. Are there any questions in the room? Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, thank you. I'm Rachel Gardner for your PhD.
single largest recipient of land in terms of acres and also economic value back, you know, originally when the Lincoln University was created. I'm just wondering if there's any talk about setting up special financial aid for indigenous Native American students as part of your campaign plan.
That's a great question. There's actually three things that, three responses to that. So for people who don't know, the Morrill Act that created Cornell, what happened was it wasn't that Cornell itself stole the land, but it turns out that a lot of the land that was given to Cornell for its endowment was land that was taken in pretty brutal ways from indigenous people by the federal government. So we are doing three things in response to that. One isn't actually in response to that. One is in response to being on the Iacona homeland, is that we now do have a land acknowledgement as a symbol of respect. The second thing is we are working right now, in fact, Joel Molina, the Vice President for University Relations, is one of the person who's working on a webpage that will prominently talk about our history and you know, say what we understand about it and make sure that people understand that history. The third, it goes to student recruiting. So Cornell is committed, as part of the Ivy League, we are committed to only providing need-based aid. So we don't provide, I hate the term merit-based aid because everyone who comes here is meritorious, but we only provide aid based on financial need, and we will stick to that. However, what we are doing is we're working to do more recruiting of Native students as undergraduates, indigenous students to come here. And quite honestly, most of the indigenous students, by virtue of their history, come from families where they will get almost complete aid anyway. So that's how we're addressing that.
Thank you.
Are there any more? Yeah, if you just turn on your mic by hitting that small black thing there.
Yes?
Yeah, on the actual platform of it.
Wait.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, it's
okay. Oh, because otherwise,
yeah, they can't hear.
Hi, thank you so much for being here. My name is Ava. I'm a first-year PhD student in government. This is my first time in a new PhD meeting, so I'm sorry if my question has a very obvious answer. In your discussion of the $5 billion campaign, you mentioned that some money is being set aside for graduate students specifically. And I was just wondering if you could talk a bit more about the process of how that funding will be allocated and then graduate students will have a say in how it will be allocated?
So the $500 million is a target, right? So that's what we're aiming for. And what we do when we go out to donors is we say, this is a real priority. One of the things we really want is funding, mostly it's going to be financial stipend-based, right? And then the money that comes in, the donor may say, give it to any graduate student at all. Or they may say, give it to a PhD student in government. The only thing they can't do is they can't use protected classes. So they can't say, it has to be a woman, it has to be a person of color. That's not legal. But they can say, it has to be in government, or it has to be in CALS, or it has to be in ILR. So it's not really a matter of, like the student has a say in it, it's stipend money. And all the deans are trying to raise it for all their students. And we always try to have as much flexibility as possible. So job one is, you know, you just support a graduate student. And they say, no, I'm a law school faculty, I'm a law school graduate, I only want to get into law school, and then we go with that. It's not a stupid question at all. It's really trying.
Are there any more questions in person?
Go ahead,
A quick statement. The first thing you talked about under university updates was about sustainability.
Uh-huh.
And just a shameless plug, the solar panels went live or going live soon, and there's a solar panel on Friday that Student in Campus Life is doing. I'm one of the panelists. It's going to be really fun. Y'all should all come.
Okay, go hear Liz talk about solar panel.
And
solar
just like
panel.
Sustainability efforts
that
I'm
hearing. I think they're going to call it solar panel squared.
Oh, that is cute.
That's cute, right?
Yeah.
We've got another on Zoom, if that's okay.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, so our last one here.
Uh-huh. Hi, Professor Collison, host of the Apologies for Not Screw, if you're in quote unquote in person. I don't have great internet and can't really afford to get better internet. I just want to sort of circle back a little bit, Professor Collison. This is a little bit of a sort of statement, but also there's a question attached to it, which is just to sort of linger, I think, a little bit on the point that you made about, our sort of position as graduate students, and I'm assuming sort of an extension of that as graduate instructors, to sort of affect a certain level of change within sort of institutional culture that currently, we sort of see very negatively affecting our students. I don't know, I just don't know to what extent we are sort of empowered to do so, which is to say that I've heard, several horror stories, and they really are horror stories, from undergraduates specifically about the enforcement of already pretty inflexible policy on the part of other tenured professors, right? So I'm sitting here, I'm a graduate student. I have sort of very limited institutional, sort of opportunities to address the behavior of other instructors. And yet, my students are coming to my classroom very sort of burdened by the effects of, another person's classroom policies. I don't know if you heard about this, but there was an undergraduate who had a story about having to actually throw up into her mask. Because her chemistry professor refused to allow her additional time on an exam, wouldn't let her sort of take an exam at a later date, and she was forced to attend that exam very obviously sick. So it's things like that I see are really truly an extension, right, of this sort of broader cultural institutional attitude towards this, right, idea or construct of academic rigor, right, of sort of this placement of us being an Ivy, which is incredibly concerning to me. And also, again, not something that I can change. I have no effect, I have no ability to affect the behavioral or policy-based stances of, tenured faculty in their other classrooms, despite the fact that those stances have direct and manifest very negative sort of outputs for my classes and for my students who I ostensibly, care about very deeply. So I'm wondering, what I'm supposed to do. I don't entirely know sort of how much and to what extent I can be sort of that cultural change. When there are so many institutional and other sort of individuals who are a barrier to making that change. So any sort of input you have on that would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, well, look, I certainly didn't mean to put all of the burden on graduate students for cultural change. I was saying that cultural change is something that everyone in the community has to think about, and different people are going to react to in different ways. And even the fact that you're listening to students is a signal of a certain sort of culture. But you're right, you don't have the authority to change academic policy. What you can do is you can talk to the faculty member if you're concerned. You can, if a student was told to go to class sick, they should definitely be telling the department chair about that. I mean, we don't want students to, apart from the trauma to the student, we don't want people to go sick being class sick. That's a public health
measure. What I'm saying is that And this doesn't just relate to competitiveness. This relates, one of the things I hear all the time is, oh, we have to self-censor because we're afraid that if we say something, we're going to be canceled. Well, that's not something I can fix from the top down. I mean, I can talk about the importance of free speech. I can talk about the importance of hearing diverse voices on campus and listening even when you disagree. But if students are canceling each other, there's really not anything I can do about that. So my point was not to put it on you per se, but to say that culture is big and complex and we all just have to take steps together to do what we think is right. I'm not sick. It's very dry in here. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. And I think from now on, even though the rest of you can wear whatever you want, Preston has to get dressed up. And
All right, so we will move on to the breakout divisions. Let's see what time it is.
Cool. All right, so we're going to move on to a discussion item on hybrid meetings. Unless the arts and humanities voting member. No. Okay. So we'll skip over that because the IOR representative is appointed by the school. So we'll skip over that. So we'll move on to the discussion on hybrid meetings. So we just wanted to bring this up, kind of talk about it, allow for discussion.
Stephanie, before you start, can I have a motion that we limit this to 10 minutes so we can get to the other resolutions that will allow us to hopefully simplify?
Can you repeat yourself with the mic? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, so I'm making a motion that we limit the discussion about hybrid meetings to 10 minutes so that we can get to sort of a lot of resolutions that are really essential to the business of GPSIA.
Okay, any objections?
Second.
Any objections? Okay. All right, so I just kind of want to start this off. We decided to do this kind of in unison with the university, right? So, as people are required to be in person for classes, we're operating under the same assumption that if you need accommodations, we'll give them to you. And looking at what happened in last year's GPSA and kind of at the beginning of the semester, there was a lot of vacancies. We were able to fill those vacancies, once we moved more to an in-person format, kind of increasing the engagement. Because it's always been about engagement, right, and facilitating a more productive meeting, and kind of looking to provide a more favorable outcome, having to do with, students and making it easier to participate and get things done quicker. So, we're looking to operate like this for the rest of the semester, we're kind of keeping an eye on things, especially as we go into break and come back, and understanding what we need to do for next semester. It's kind of up in the air at this point. So, we kind of open up the floor for the discussion.
So we've got two Zoom hands raised.
Thank you. Oops, can you hear me now?
Yes.
So you actually provided a really good segue by skipping the section of the agenda for voting on arts and humanities voting members, which there are vacancies. I just want to highlight that there are several people, I believe, including myself, on this call remotely today, and who are finally able to participate remotely today, who would probably willingly take those positions. Some of us, including myself, have done it for multiple years in the past. So I want to make clear that by not making these meetings accessible, that is creating vacancies where people would otherwise participate. I guess in general, I have tried repeatedly throughout the semester to communicate with the executive committee that I want to put it on the table right off the bat that even having this discussion at all is pretty problematic. The idea that mostly able students without compromised immune systems or those that are willing to take risks that many of us don't have the privilege to take, the idea that these are that it's just these people who are discussing whether or not we should be keeping policies that are discriminatory and ableist and exclude participation is really problematic. And so I just want to suggest that I don't know that we should even be having this discussion at all. I think it's worth also putting on the floor that the policy change from hybrid to in-person participation only was made and justified by the executive committee in that they said that it was within their power of the bylaws. And I just want to leave you by saying that that means it's also within your power to just do do the right thing and change it. So thanks.
Yeah, no, definitely thank you for raising that concern. I just want to highlight that the Victim Committee has given multiple people accommodations to be able to participate via Zoom once they are asked for them. David?
I would just like to share that I also have been disappointed by the Executive Committee's communications regarding this issue. And in particular, I asked for this issue to be put on the agenda after the first email came out, and I was told that the Executive Committee would not devote floor time to this discussion. And so I'm glad we're having it today, but I'm also disappointed by the way this is played out.
David, I think you're mischaracterizing the email, and I think if you pulled it up, it would say that it would be a disservice to the discussion. At no point did you ask for it to be added to the agenda, and I do understand that came up in your conversation with Preston the other day, but we can refer to the email, gladly. I'll yield the floor.
Yes, Liz?
Thanks, Damien. I think...
Sorry, point of order. The Zoom's muted so people can't hear.
Okay. Okay, go ahead, Liz.
Yeah. I think this conversation is similar to a point that was brought up in the mental health discussion about President Pollack, with President Pollack when she said, we're talking about culture, and she was like, if you are a student and you have an issue with a faculty member, then you should go to the head of the department. And just like, given how long I've been here, I've been hearing over and over again that it's an extra, like, emotional burden, an extra emotional labor to take that extra step. And so that's kind of how I'm hearing the people who are saying, like, it's not okay that we aren't having these hybrid meetings because it's just another thing that they, like, have to add on to their list of things to do is, like, request accommodations when they feel like it's something that should be not... you shouldn't even need accommodations for. So that's just kind of what I'm hearing, and if anybody has any, like, clarifying points, I just, like, don't want to misunderstand what people's arguments are.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you bringing up that concern. But we have our 10 minutes for this. We can definitely circle back on this. You have more time?
No, we have 4 more minutes. I've been counting.
Oh, okay.
Maggie's got the floor.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Maggie, go ahead. Hey, so I don't know if everyone who's Maggie, I'm a PhD candidate, I'm a professor of English, and I just sort of want to add on to Becca and both Becca and Liz's voice and to say that, I am privileged in the fact that my disability is sort of been made legible to the institution in a way that, show that I have access to the people, who need it to make that legible. So I have access to a doctor and to a healthcare team that, has ensured that, my access is protected sort of at the level of the institution in a way that a lot of students with disabilities, and particularly undergraduate students, right, who don't have that level of access, simply just will never attain. So I want to emphasize that it is, for me, as someone who is disabled and has a documented disability, deeply inappropriate that this decision was one made sort of unilaterally and without any input from disabled graduate students and from disabled graduate field reps. It's also frankly, deeply inappropriate to sort of be debating the merits of expanding access to disabled graduate students or compromised graduate students. It's questionable to me as to sort of whether or not, quite frankly, the executive team, despite the fact that, you are empowered to be making this decision, whether or not you had duly informed yourselves of sort of the weight of making that decision. Because again, as far as I know, that decision was made with very little input from disabled graduate students. And I speak not just sort of as somebody directly involved in the assembly, but I speak also as someone, who's talked as a field representative to people in my department who would otherwise, have enjoyed attending GPS meetings, right, as GPS meetings as a sort of purview as a graduate student, but who have not because of that lack of access. Access is not debatable. It should not be debatable. Furthermore, I am very happy and would have been very happy before now having been given that access, granted that access, I suppose, to have, you know, run for and possibly, you know, based on people's decision-making, been happy to fulfill the role of the community sort of member. But again, that lack of access has precluded me from seriously, you know, putting forth myself as, you know, a possible participant in that role. So if, you know, this decision has been made purely, right, on the assumption that it will improve engagement, I mean, it hasn't, right? So I want to reemphasize that point that Beth is so astutely made, and to also just object in very strenuous terms to the idea that access as a concept, but also as a material fact for which, you know, disabled people have been begging, which is, you know, not a position many of us like to assume, but we have to because the institution just sort of refuses to recognize our needs adequately, in order to sort of participate at, you know, the most base level of institutional functioning, right? So it's not just a CSA, right? This is something that disabled students have to, in an iterative and reiterative fashion, experience with every professor they have, with every interaction they have with student disability services, with every email they have to send to, you know, politely request remote access to campus events, to campus speakers. You know, this is like it equates in both labor and emotional labor, right, to what is essentially a full-time job. So the fact that, you know, this is sort of up for debate or up for sort of, like, questioning the veracity or sort of the utmost need of access, at a very base level, you know, I should also sort of reiterate, like, you know, this is not exceptional. This is the bare minimum, okay? So that's all what I find to be sort of most pressing and troubling about this initiative, sort of about, you know, holding forth people's, you know, rights, holding forth people's, you know, academic access as sort of a question, right, on a floor. It's deeply troubling to me, not only sort of as a graduate student, but as a disabled person.
Yeah, thank you, Maggie. With that, we are definitely at time, and we are
end the discussion by 5 minutes.
Second. Any objections? Is that an objection or? Okay. All right, so seeing none, we can extend the debate by 5 minutes.
Could you brush your mic if you had it?
Okay, it should be on. I don't think the light on yours is working. Looks like it's working now.
I'll try to help you. This is weird. But so I just, like, I think there's a lot of feelings about this, but I would like to just kind of think about how we can move forward. So two things. Like, I understand the reasoning for, you know, possibly and all of that, but also a lot of grad students don't have classes at all, and so don't necessarily come to campus as much as they used to, maybe, but also a lot of things that I participate in as a grad student are hybrid, including seminars, where they happen both in person and online, or still are happening all completely online. So I just want to point out that while classes are in person, there's a lot of activities happening around campus that are hybrid, and I think that there are feasible ways to do that. And so I think if we have this room, we have the technology, I feel like we should try to do it. I think clearly And then the other thing I want to say is that, like, we do have a mechanism for understanding how people feel about this, and that is to take a vote on it. And so I would like to kind of throw it out there that I think this is the last meeting of the semester, but maybe at the first meeting of next semester, we actually take a vote on whether meetings should happen as they have been happening or in a hybrid format, because I think that's typically how the assembly operates, and I think that would ameliorate a lot of people's concerns.
Real quick, I just want to say, Meredith, I appreciate how you framed that at the beginning of the semester it wasn't working, because I do think it's like, if we're going to look at like this discussion or issue like holistically, like I do think that it's fair that at the beginning of the semester, like being in person was a good option, just because like we all know that the GPSA hasn't like historically had super great participation attendance, so like I understand where the initiative was coming from. But I also love what you said with your saying, like, how do we move forward? And so, yeah, I just wanted to say I appreciate that this discussion is finally happening, and that people are, like, open and willing to share, and just also, like, want to encourage us not to, maybe not to, like, attack, like, people, but continue to focus on, like, learning and growing together, like, I think things can mutually exist, right? And so, yeah.
I was going to say, I really love your point, Meredith. I think, based on what I've heard from before, I mean, I wasn't here earlier, but it sounds like it might be worth giving another shot, but maybe with input from the people who are in this room. So if we do think we want to take a vote for the first meeting of the next semester, that gives us quite a bit of time for everyone here to consult with our peers and see if there are recommendations that we can kind of crowdsource to see how this could work, because I know hybrid is really tough, but if you set clear expectations or guidelines for how it could work, like for example, we've got 9 comments in the chat currently, and I don't know if there's a rule or process for those being read to make sure that those who are online are able to participate. So just something to keep in mind if we do a vote, just garnering feedback and input from everybody before that might help everybody feel comfortable with the new direction.
Thanks. Cody?
Yeah, so thank you. I'll try to be really quick, but I, for one, thank you for bringing this discussion time. I do think it is a bit overdue, but I also understand that opening up this discussion is an important step towards correcting the current policies and opening up the accessibility in general. I also recognize that you guys have had a tremendous burden to try to make the GPSA operate, stepping in at the last moment and, you know, trying to just look at things from a pragmatic perspective. So I understand that that was a decision that was made primarily just to get some momentum behind the GPSA and get things working. So I want to just express that I, you know, appreciate you guys stepping in and trying to be decisive, even if it may have been a bit of a misstep to be as exclusionary as it has been. And I fully endorse this idea of moving forward, trying to be as inclusionary as possible, while highly encouraging people to come in person if possible, and just encouraging people to participate in any form possible. So, you know, this is a complicated situation. This is, you know, there's a lot of things that were going on, and I understand that people are very emotional about this stuff, and rightfully so, when there's a lot of sort of personal involvement over the history of the GPSA. So, thank you. And I don't know that I cogently got my point across, but yeah.
Also, thank you.
Becca has her hand raised.
Yeah, we are over time at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are.
Very
old. It's up to you all.
Okay. So, we can move on to new business of the day with Resolution 11. David, do you want to give the floor to David here for this one?
Okay.
I don't have the. Is Wendy? Wendy's pulling it up.
I got it.
In the meantime, are we entertaining any motions to extend the meeting?
Motion to extend the meeting by 10 minutes. Logically, the GPSA Finance Commission can't like give student organizations funds for those rules. So one of the effects of this is that many student organizations can't really have any food at their events at all, except in special and so this was brought up at our last meeting, and Walker. Brought up kindly drafted this resolution for us, and so basically it reviews that situation and points out that so one of the effects of these food restrictions are that student organizations are having trouble engaging the people who would usually come to them. So no snacks at your seminar, no food at your coffee break, whatever. No coffee at your coffee break. And so this resolution essentially requests that the university relax the restrictions and points out our recent low case counts and the green status.
All right, open it up for any questions or debate. Kyle?
This might be a stupid question. How is this different from the new winter guidelines that the university released, and if you can have food events?
Are there new university guidelines? It's probably the question.
I'm the chair of the Finance Commission. I just want to ask this because the university has put out some guidelines for which of the things you can have food at events, but the GPSA cannot fund events. You can't fund events that take place outside of the academic year, so we have to not touch it.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. I actually didn't know that. Yeah, because people actually sent us the new guidelines last week, and we hadn't sent those out yet. But okay, interesting. Please.
Oh my, I hate this thing. I also know that case numbers are going up by like a good bit post these like break travels. Like cases are like now, I think between 30 and 50, and they're anticipating them to continue to rise. And also like just uncertainty with this new variant. So just saying that, I would hate to put. Maybe like strategically, if you would hold off on this resolution until next semester to see what next semester looks like, because if you send it now and then the president says no, then you're gonna have to do another one, if that makes sense, to like save time and energy, given that like we don't know what next semester is gonna look like, and there's like what was just said, we only have a week and a half left anyway.
So I would propose a sort of compromise solution where if you replace
Finn, you turn over your mic, please.
Sorry about that. So I would propose a sort of compromise solution where we just add in the language that says while we remain in green COVID alert, that they relax. Right? So instead of effective as soon as possible, just say while we are in green alert status.
so that it could go back and forth, it could be flexible. Makes sense.
Would be my suggested amendment.
Mm-hmm. We got the Zoom first before we
go
back to
Hold on here. Is that what?
It's at the bottom.
Yes, the final line.
Should I recommend a slightly different?
Yeah.
What did we say? As long as it remains safe, so then we don't try to make them tie up to the group.
Yeah, okay. So, anybody second that amendment?
I'll second David's.
Okay. Anybody in opposition?
Just a quick question. You just said that as long as it remains safe, but who defines safe?
The university.
Wouldn't that essentially mean anything besides green alert?
So I suggested the difference because I think we are in green and have been for a long time, and food is, I think the maybe you've been remembering this, but I think the requirement for food at events has changed while we've been in green. So I think that I'm just suggesting this different phrasing so that it's sort of, as long as it's a safe thing to do.
Here's the challenge with that. The university has decided it's not safe. That's why these restrictions are in place. And I'm not trying to speak for the university here. I'm just saying, if you say safe, then the answer is going to be absolutely no.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody know if this is the essay is under the same guidelines? Because I know for a fact that undergraduate student organizations have had events with food. Right, but they get their funding from the SA. Like, the structure is the same.
They wouldn't be allowed under the current rules.
Okay. So do we want to move forward with the amendment, or
should we vote on it?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I had my hand up for the last part. I didn't get back my question. So this is, I don't have a question.
Okay. Kyle?
Sorry, it's a clarification of which amendment. On changing the verb to safe or
green?
Okay.
All right, anybody opposed to that? Yeah, really, okay. Okay, so we'll add that as an amendment, so changing it to when the university is in the green level. Okay. All right, any more questions, Cody?
I'd like you to extend the meeting by 10 minutes.
Okay, awesome. Anybody opposed? No? Okay. All right, so entertain a motion to call the question for this resolution as it is amended. Okay. Second?
Second.
Okay. All right, all those in favor, raise your placard. So just one abstention. Okay, so 22 in favor, one abstention. So that resolution passes. Okay, awesome. So then we will move on to resolution 8. Very important. Ben?
Yeah, so I will keep this brief because I've already sort of given this introduction, but essentially resolution 8 allows me to act
have the appropriations committee in order to complete the byline funding and activity fee recommendations. I do now have one committee member, so that is certainly helpful, but this, it also extends the timeline, excuse me, so that we can vote on it. And according to the bylaws, our current schedule, this would be the deadline. So this resolution allows me to act and to extend the timeline, which at this point is essential because I have not yet had follow-up meetings with some of the byline-funded organizations. But I'd be happy to take questions. I know that's kind of brief.
Yeah, any questions for Ben? Okay, so, yeah, Josh.
So when do you expect to have these meetings?
So my hope is that we can have a special meeting on the 7th. For those of you who looked in the box folder, I had put a resolution, but I think we can discuss that later. But the final day of classes is the absolute deadline to have our recommendation finalized. So between now and then, I'll be having a meeting.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate how important this is, because if we can't get that recommendation out by our deadline, then we just kind of default that decision to the board trustees, so then, you know, we aren't getting, this is, you know, a big responsibility of our bodies to get that activity fee recommendation to them. So with no more any more questions, okay, so with that, entertain a motion to call a question on this amendment. Okay. All right. So something important to note is we need two-thirds for this. So what is it two-thirds of?
Two-thirds of the number of people to see the vote.
Okay.
So 22.
Okay. All right. So all those in favor, raise your placard. That was here today, so I just want to make sure there's nobody opposed, any abstentions. Okay, awesome. So then that passes. And then we'll quickly move on to Resolution 9, which was Kate.
So Resolution 9 is essentially working to amend the GPSA charter. To allow for vacant seats to be filled after four consecutive meetings. And that's basically, what was the amendment that we made to it so that it was more clear? I forgot.
Yeah, we changed it. So this is the amended version. They've changed it to 249 to 251, where it's amending that. Yeah, I think that was an amendment.
Yeah.
Okay. So just to make it more clear.
And that's pretty much it.
Okay.
Just to fill positions more easily and with fewer hassles or hoops to jump through.
Great. So
if we were to pass this, when would it take effect so that we could actually fill positions?
Immediately. Yeah, since it's been, I guess, there are the two, well, I guess there's three that are open, so then it would take effect, you know, for the next meeting.
Okay, so then to follow up, I'd like to make a motion that we table this until the first meeting of the next semester, so that we can have some more discussion in regards to people participating remotely.
I second.
Okay. Nick? Yeah, I think you're right.
Oh,
is it working?
I just wanted to say that maybe we should consider leaving it open to that division for at least another meeting after it becomes vacant, because ultimately there is a reason that we have representatives from each division before we throw it open at large. So maybe one to two meetings, it stays in that division, and then it becomes at large, just so that a certain group of students isn't underrepresented.
So,
I know that the so this is amending it to make it after the fourth meeting.
Oh, I thought so. Or becomes vacant during the term of office, or remains vacant after the fourth meeting of the term.
So the fourth
meeting thing is totally fine, but the becomes vacant during the term of office. So if I'm a voting member for natural sciences and I resign today, then I think next meeting it should be open at large.
That's actually the current charter.
That's what it says.
Yeah. So currently, if there is a voting member and GPSA that resigns, then it opens up to other GPSA members.
Immediately?
Yeah.
Oh, then, yeah, never mind. I mean, is that something to think about?
Yeah. I think we have a hand online.
I'd just like to add that I think that tabling this is probably a good idea. It seems inappropriate to even contemplate this until we decide whether that these meetings are actually going to be accessible to people who haven't been able to participate.
Okay, yeah, so we want to, anybody want to motion to table this?
Yeah, Cody did, and I do
that. Okay, so any objections? Seeing none, we'll table this to the next meeting. Okay, and we'll move on to Resolution 10.
Yeah, I think Wendy's going to put it up.
Okay. Good.
Thanks, Wendy. So as we discussed in our last meeting, Resolution 10 establishes a Vice President of Finance. We do a lot of coordination with currently the Appropriations Committee Chair. And so this would establish currently Ben's position, the Appropriations Committee Chair, as the Vice President of Finance, and give that person a seat on the Executive Committee so that someone controlling the finance did have a say in the day-to-day operations on the Executive Committee. And then currently Caroline's position as the Finance Commission, it would establish that committee as the Finance Committee, as we discussed in our last meeting. But I'll take any questions again today.
Thank you, Philip.
Hmm?
So it would make...
No, I had it right.
So Caroline would become the Appropriations Chair.
That's what I said. Yeah, I got it. Yeah, I got it right.
Okay, sure.
She'd be the chairman within me.
He'd be the Vice President of Finance.
So it would be a two-member committee?
No. So he meant that Caroline would become the Appropriations Chair.
So one thing I think is worth clarifying quickly, if I may, is just that it's not me. My term actually will end. So this is more just realigning the structure of the organization so that it makes sense in a logical way, so that the Appropriations Chair right now is sort of the umbrella, or the Appropriations Committee right now is sort of the umbrella of finance in the organization, with the Finance Commission being within that. So realigning the language so that it reflects the actual structure of the organization. I think it's complicated to talk about right now in the short term, because it's like which is which. But long term, it aligns much better. Just language and function.
Caroline?
No, I think we talked a little bit about the confusion this might create in the last meeting, and I think we'll have to really communicate this to you know, the folks who liaise with the GPSA in order to help them understand what the switch entails, and then who I think Cannon just put in the chat whether or not the Vice President would be in charge of appropriations. So we need to communicate that you know, to the different organizations, you know, working with the GPSA to make sure that was clear at the, you know, if this resolution passes.
What would be the relationship between the Vice President of Finance and the head of the Appropriations Committee?
Just, I guess what it
so
is currently?
Yeah, that there would be no change. It's just a change in the language and a move to put the VP as part of the executive committee. But the relationship shouldn't change. It's just aligning the language with the structure of the organization as it is.
And the charter doesn't change. It's literally just words, which is like a name switch.
So when would it be the vice president and president of appropriations in the separate committee, or is it just those two?
So there's the VP of finance who would remain the committee chair. So you and I are the appropriations committee.
No.
That nothing about that would change except the name.
Any more questions? Okay, and then your motion to David?
Yes, so you said nothing would change about the appropriations committee, I guess, except its name and what our other committee members' relationship to the executive committee. So is it just that the appropriations committee gets renamed and its chair is a member of the executive committee?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And
you
add a VP?
No. That position would become the VP.
Yeah.
We're not adding like another person.
Yeah. Caroline? Yeah. Just based off of the fact that like kind of what the charter says and what the committees itself do, their names are contrary to what they actually do. It's confusing now, but I think that, like Ben said, down the road, this will just make things way easier. And, you know, something we talked about last time is, you know, those liaisons and, like, treasurers of those organizations that we fund, those are constantly changing hand. And I think that the important part is to just make sure that we open up communication and make sure that people know about the change and that going forward they, you know who to direct it to. Cody, do you have a question?
I'm just going to make a motion to extend the meeting by a hopefully unnecessary 5 minutes.
Okay. So, David?
So I have to admit, I feel more concerned about the name change than about the actual material effect of the resolution. And I think that maybe it's hard to know how many web pages on the internet mention GPSAFC. It's just like everywhere when you're dealing with a student organization and funding. And I think it will be difficult to sort of stamp out the GPSAFC from the internet. And I'm not sure I really see the benefit that we get from doing the name change.
Yeah.
Compared to doing the actual restructuring.
Carolyn?
Is there any urgency in passing this today?
No.
Yeah.
Okay, then I would motion that we table this to the next meeting.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Alright, so we'll go to committee updates. We'll go to Damien on the executive committee.
None for the executive committee.
Just one thing I want to add and make sure that we get into. It's not on the agenda, but something that Ben mentioned earlier, we need to call a special meeting next week. We're hoping to maybe do it next Monday, just kind of keep it in line with what we're already doing, same time, same place, but we need to vote on that as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about the importance, I guess?
Also, I actually can't be here on Monday.
Okay.
Since this meeting is really my recommendation, I'm hoping we can do it on Tuesday, which is the final day of classes.
Okay.
But I'll talk briefly about the importance of it, which is to vote on a recommendation for the activity, which is one of the primary duties of this body, and one of the ways that we fund anything that we do that requires funding. Organizations, essentially
essential that we do that. In my mind, at least, I've had, if you look in the box, I had put a resolution to this effect, which I don't think we necessarily need. But I do think that given the inconvenience of the meeting for everyone here and the sort of surprise nature of it, and frankly, just the terrible timing, which I apologize for, I do think that we should allow Zoom voting and Zoom representation at that meeting because we do need to have a quorum, and I think it will be impossible for all of us to get there. Not to mention we don't have a room reserved.
Do you want to, do we have that resolution to pull up? Then the resolution?
It's fairly straightforward.
Okay. Caroline?
Sorry, what meeting would be on Tuesday or would be next Tuesday?
Yeah, next Tuesday.
What's the day and time that you get there? So
okay. Cody?
Is there any, I mean, so in the past, we have had instances of passing a resolution by email. Like all of the voting members, is there any problem with doing that in this case, given the logistical difficulties?
Yeah. So there is past precedent for email votes, and I think maybe what could be done since this short notice is. Ben, if you're setting the, I mean, I guess you're the committee. Is it just you?
Well, it's Josh and I now.
So the two of you, if you two have your recommendation, you can send it out to the GPSA by email, and then the voting members would be allowed to vote by email at a certain time. Then the results could be announced by the executive committee by Preston, and then that's how that could be done. But we would have to approve that now. To allow for that to happen.
How do we approve that now?
Just vote on approving it, like motion for that to happen.
So I motion for what Nick just said to happen.
Okay. All right. All those in favor, raise your placard.
Preston, if I may, it's Gina from the Office of the Assemblies.
Yeah.
Actually, the charter calls for very specific actions on how to pass this with each recommendation having a vote. So it's this one in particular would not be allowed to have a an email vote. The charter is very, very specific about how the resolution for passing the student activity fee is needs to be passed.
Thank you. Thank you for pointing that out, Gina. I do recall the charter also having a provision for the membership to overrule the charter with a 2/3 majority vote of everyone that's seated. If I'm not correct, they can appeal the decision, and then, overrule it. So if that's correct per Robert's rule and the charter, then maybe that would be an alternate approach.
Yeah, I don't know that, I'd have to review what you're referencing, but, again, the rules for this particular resolution are very specific. So, but let me know what I can do to help confirm your how you'd like to proceed.
I think if we could just look that up really quick, I think that would help a lot. Cody? Yeah. hand online?
Oh, sorry. I meant to take my hand down, but I was just going to make a kind of obnoxious comment that we didn't seem to have any trouble discussing alternative ways to host meetings in this conversation. So I just wanted to highlight that.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Should we go through just updates on Netflix?
Yeah, we can do that. Kate? An update.
Your update of your committee. Operations has no update.
Okay. Ben?
My updates have generally been given already. I mean, I have a draft recommendation.
Okay. Genesis.
So the communication committee made a few posts on LinkedIn and also the Twitter accounts and also Instagram about the Cornell Suns article about GPSA. So if you have time, check it out. That's it for my update.
Caroline?
Update.
Okay. David?
No updates.
Sean?
This just got its separate email ID, and I'll be reaching out to people from that shortly.
Kyle?
Hello again, everyone. Programming chair here. I'm still looking for people to be on my committee. Ever heard of Gradball? It sounds like it's a blast, and we need people to help plan it. So if you've got friends who love event planning, please have them email me. I'm KPK59. That's KPK59@cornell.edu. I'd love to have you.
Cody? Okay. And Shane? Okay.
So, yes. Based on Article 5 of the bylaws, line 740, Section A, I am making a motion to suspend the rule pertaining to having an in-person meeting for the Appropriations Committee motion for, you know what I'm talking about. So I'd like to suspend that section. And to do that, we need 2/3 of the GPSA voting members in favor. A second.
Okay, all those in favor?
I'm not quite sure how to raise my hand. I don't seem to have an option. I apologize. I could just, I guess, point of order.
Go ahead.
The charter supersedes the bylaws. And the process for passing this resolution is very specific. So the bylaws, anything in the bylaws would not supersede the charter language in this case.
Nick?
Yes, thank you. Ultimately, though, the membership supersedes anything else, so the membership is fully within its right to suspend whatever document they choose to do so, considering they're here. So although the bylaws might not supersede the power that's derived from the charter comes from the membership. So I think the membership can suspend it.
Okay, I'll allow it. Can we? So we got 1 minute. All right. So all those in favor? Okay, that's
2/3.
All right, so after that email, we'll have Ben send those out, or we will send them out, and then we'll be in touch. Everybody, if we don't see you, have a great break. We're also going to the Bidrec Barn after this. The first round is on us, so if you want to come on out, we'll see you there.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.